بدي تصارحني في الأسباب تنكرني ولا تشتي تصارحني.
This is KBOO Portland. Time is 5 o'clock. Coming up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia in Portland. In 2018, the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal opened, the first tar sands by rail export terminal on the West Coast. The Center for a Sustainable Economy hosts this panel discussion with activists fighting tar sands by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia, 1106 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
You're listening to Hindsight's 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years under the Trump regime.
Thanks for listening.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the trial of Jeremy Christian for stabbing two men on a MAX train in 2017 began today.
The first case of coronavirus in the U.S. has been reported in Washington State.
And in international news, Madagascar has pledged to plant 60 million trees over the next few months.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 21st, 2020. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The trial of Jeremy Christian got underway today. Christian is charged with fatally stabbing two men and seriously injuring a third in 2017 aboard a MAX train in Portland. Christian had been verbally harassing two girls on the train, one wearing a hijab, and spouting racial slurs when he was confronted by three men standing up for the girls. An altercation broke out, and Christian pulled a knife, stabbing all three. Ricky Best and Taliesin Namkhaimeche were both killed in the attack, while Micah David Cole Fletcher was seriously injured. Christian fled the train at the Hollywood MAX station, but was quickly arrested just a few blocks away. Christian has described himself as a white nationalist and is known to have ties to Patriot Prayer. He had spoken at one of their rallies not long before the attack. At his initial arraignment in May of 2017, Christian went on a hate-filled rant as he was being escorted out of the courtroom. Christian is charged with assault, murder, and attempted murder. The charge of aggravated murder, a crime that potentially carries the death penalty, was dismissed by a judge last year after the state of Oregon passed a law narrowing the definition of the crime.
A disease that was found only last month in China has been reported in Washington State. This is the U.S.'s first case of the new virus. The disease was brought by a U.S. citizen who recently returned to the Seattle area in the middle of last week after traveling to the Wuhan province in China, where the outbreak began. The man is in his 30s and is in good condition at a hospital in Everett. Coronavirus has sparked an outbreak in Asia and is under intense monitoring around the world. Late last week, U.S. health officials began screening passengers returning from central China at U.S. airports. The virus was first identified last month in the Chinese province of Wuhan and so far has infected more than 300 people and killed six. A prominent Chinese scientist said on Monday that the disease is capable of spreading from person to person. The virus has infected people in five countries, including South Korea, Thailand, Japan, and now the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said, quote, human coronaviruses are common throughout the world. Seven different coronaviruses that scientists know of can infect people and make them sick. Some human coronaviruses were identified many years ago, and some have been identified recently. Human coronaviruses commonly cause mild to moderate illness in people worldwide. Two newer human coronaviruses, MERS-CoV and SARS-CoV, have been known to frequently cause severe illness.
Governor Kate Brown said on Friday that Oregon lawmakers should not pass campaign contribution limits this year. As a result, voters will likely have to decide in November on a state constitutional amendment that would create political donation limits without knowing what those financial caps might be. In 2019, the State House passed a bill that would have limited contributions to House and Senate candidates to $1,000 and $1,500, respectively. It would also limit contributions to statewide candidates to $2,800. However, the bill died in the Senate. This year, there's been speculation that lawmakers may pass a similar plan to give voters a better idea of the impact it would have. On Friday, Governor Brown said, quote, I've been working on this issue 25 years. We should wait and see what the voters have to say on that particular measure. Brown did not mention any specific benefits of waiting until at least 2021 to pass the statewide contribution cap. Oregon's lack of state campaign contribution limits has allowed powerful interests to finance the governor's race and other statewide and legislative elections. A 2019 Oregonian series revealed that corporate entities gave more money to Oregon lawmakers on a per capita basis over a decade than in any other state in the country.
It's a new year, and pharmacists say people should take the time to reflect on the medications they're using, as some medications can counteract each other or cause harmful side effects. KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu has more on this story.
It's a new year, and pharmacists say people should take time to reflect on the medications they're using. An annual evaluation is especially important for older adults. One in four people age 65 and older take five or more medications for chronic disease management. Rob Reinhart, a pharmacist with Jackson Care Connect in Medford, says to complicate things more, folks often have multiple providers prescribing them medications. He says a specialist might prescribe you something that interacts badly with medication from your primary care physician.
And throw on top of that, if you add in supplements or herbals or things like that, that no one knows you're taking other than you, you can really set yourself up for some serious interactions that can cause hospitalizations or worse.
Reinhart says people can ask their local pharmacist to review their medications for free with them, and that pharmacists can identify which medications might interfere with each other or which they recommend discontinuing. Jason Malari is a pharmacist with Care Oregon. He says it's important to ask questions, including what the medication plan is going forward. Will it be for a short time while a person changes their lifestyle, or much longer? Malari often sees someone who's put on medication and stays on it without considering why.
What people forget is people change over time. People change not only because of time, but also because of what you're taking, what you're eating. And so you may have to evaluate those medications that you're taking more often than you probably would think.
Reinhart says patients can help pharmacists by telling them how they're feeling on certain medications, especially if they notice something after taking a new prescription.
That may help them give you some clues that, oh, this particular drug might not be tolerated well for you. Maybe there's a better alternative I can talk to the physician about getting for you that does the same thing but doesn't cause this particular side effect for you.
This is KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service. A new study from Portland State University has found that areas prone to excessive heat are disproportionately populated by low-income communities and people of color due to racist housing policies that date back more than a century. These neighborhoods are sometimes referred to as heat islands, or areas where development has exacerbated the effects of high temperatures. Nearly every city in the study, including Portland, saw higher temperatures in neighborhoods that were historically subject to discriminatory housing policies. Specifically, poorer areas had average temperatures about 5 degrees higher than their wealthier counterparts. Out of the 108 urban areas analyzed, Portland had the worst temperature discrepancy between rich and poor, with a difference of almost 13 degrees. Urban studies and planning professor at PSU, Vivek Shadas, said, quote, "The patterns of the lowest temperatures in specific neighborhoods of a city do not occur because of circumstance or coincidence. They are a result of decades of intentional investment in parks, green spaces, trees, transportation, and housing policies that provided cooling services, which also coincide with being wealthier and whiter across the country." This study is one of the first to link historic housing policies to threats from climate change. It specifically shows what many researchers have been saying for years. As extreme weather events become more common, poor communities will face a disproportionate risk.
In North Portland yesterday, several hundred people gathered for a Reclaim MLK Day march organized by Don't Shoot Portland. The march was led by children who chanted, quote, "Dr. King had a dream, I am that dream," unquote. KBOO was there and spoke with some of the participants of the rally, beginning with Teresa Rayford, who was a candidate for the mayor of Portland.
When I'm elected, not only will I step up to the plate, but we'll have a vision of leadership that exists now in the organizing that we do that we can bring to the city in a bigger fabric, and that'll provide more direct resources to people that have been committed to change for so long but feel like they haven't had the necessary resources or the support from elected leaders that we need in order to be a part of what change looks like in the world. Communities need to be the indirect alignment with our policies, because we're the recipients of what that looks like. And when we talk about equity, it should be a return on investment for the people that pay the taxes and that trust and believe that the people we elect will do the work. So we'll see what happens. I'm begging people to hold me accountable.
And what do you think is the legacy of King on this day?
Dr. King's legacy has brought us here today. We choose this day to practice nonviolent direct action because as a black leader and organizer of a civil rights movement now, I've been faced with violence and trauma connected to being able to freely express my voice and to petition my government. And so we utilize this day because the framework of the holiday exists to encourage people to protest, to encourage people to be in engagement, to petition their governments, and to understand what's happening in the world. So it's a perfect legacy. It keeps us right on track.
Jody Bagley.
And how old are your kids?
Kids are 11 and 7. We wanted to bring our kids out today to help them to know the black people and indigenous people in our community need our support, and that's important to be out here. And I think that's a legacy of King. That's not just a holiday to be at home, but Don't Shoot Portland. I think they're bringing the concerns of the black community. I think they're highlighting those concerns and bringing them more into the public discourse so we can all understand what's going on a little bit better.
My name is Jason Weber. I actually traveled down to the South with a youth group over the summer and got to go through Mississippi and Alabama, and it really opened up my eyes and thoughts of like what I can do as an able-bodied white person to just make sure that people are aware of what happened and to help educate my own children and just making sure that we can have this voice here and that we're marching together to express that dream that everyone is the same and that we all love each other and that we have this power of love and art and voice to really help show what we can do. And I think that's the biggest thing. And she was part of this art installment that they were doing with the signs, and she was touched by it on how art can bring people together and have them experience things together, and she wanted to make it a priority to come down and march as well. So this was a continuation of an art project yesterday that, you know, it was her idea to really come down here, and I didn't want to drag her down. I wanted her to have her experience and her drive to get here. So that's why we're here, right? I mean, I'm just going to be honest in my not understanding before I could understand. I was not as excited about this holiday. It was another day where we didn't have mail, the banks were closed, and we could get free parking downtown. It was just another federal holiday. And after experiencing it and seeing it and speaking with people who were around in the 60s, I wasn't, you know, I'm 35. it opened up my eyes in a completely different way. So, I mean, to be honest, this is my first Martin Luther King Jr. Day experience. And it's something that my hope is that this one, along with all the other ones around the city, the state, the country, are just about peace and love and bringing community together to march in peaceful protest, as Dr. King chose to do the entire time during his protest as well. We came up here to support Don't Shoot Portland and to, I mean, be a part of their very peaceful march, just bringing art together, bringing community together, bringing bodies, families, people together, just to express the awesome dream that Dr. Martin Luther King had.
Kenneth Obiano. I mean, I think doing walks like this are like really what help people come together and to like show that there's like people shouldn't be racist. Yeah, I think walks like these are like really good.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
Those were sounds from yesterday's march and rally to reclaim MLK, organized by the local branch of Black Lives Matter, Don't Shoot Portland.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Project Censored, the top censored news stories. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with periods of rain and a high of 49 degrees. Today in history, in 1977, the oldest living U.S. president, Jimmy Carter, granted an unconditional pardon to hundreds of thousands of men who evaded the draft during the Vietnam War. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the hopes of men the world over."
A party on Sunday at a Kansas City bar celebrating the Chiefs win came to an abrupt end when a man opened fire at a line of people waiting to get inside shortly after midnight. The gunfire resulted in one death, while 15 others were wounded. The suspected shooter was killed on the scene by an armed private security guard. Kansas City Police Chief Richard Smith identified the shooter as 29-year-old Jerron Swift and the person who was fatally shot as 25-year-old Raven Parks. The injured victims were all taken to a local hospital, with at least three in critical condition.
The Supreme Court has declined to take up two cases that are related to the 2014 Flint water crisis. This means the Supreme Court has allowed city residents to pursue a lawsuit against city and Michigan state officials over the water contamination. Roughly 25,000 people have sued. The Flint water crisis arose after the city's water source was switched from Lake Huron to the Flint River, which was known to be more corrosive. Government officials did not adequately treat the river water to reduce the corrosive effects on old pipes. As a result, Flint residents were exposed to water that had been tainted with lead. 12 people died after the contaminated water led to an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease. The justices rejected two petitions filed by Flint regulators and the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality that sought a review of a ruling from a lower court. Flint residents who were exposed to contaminated water argued that city and state officials violated their constitutional right to bodily integrity. However, city and state officials wanted the suit to be tossed out, saying they should be shielded from being sued. A federal district court, as well as the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, sided with the Flint residents. In the Supreme Court filing, lawyers for the Michigan officials argued that they, quote, "did not intentionally or purposefully inject plaintiffs with lead or force them to ingest anything."
Famed rock singer and former reality TV star Ozzy Osbourne has announced that he is suffering from Parkinson's disease. The 71-year-old Osbourne took a bad fall during a show on New Year's Eve of 2018 which caused nerve damage and required neck surgery. The former Black Sabbath frontman said that he attributed the numbness he was experiencing to the fall, but doctors have now found that Osborne does have a mild form of Parkinson's. Ozzy's spouse Sharon Osborne said, quote, "It's not a death sentence, but it affects certain nerves in your body. You have a good day, then a really bad day," end quote. There had been some recent rumors about his health, and Osborne has expressed relief that it is now out in the open, adding that he is grateful to his fans for their support.
Concerns have been raised about proposed mining near Silver City, South Dakota, and the body of a teenage girl who went missing in Montana has been found. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Forest Service is not allowed to say no to mining, but can insist on protections for surface resources that emerged during a recent open house held at the Mystic District Station in the Black Hills of South Dakota. A Minneapolis prospecting company, F3 Gold, wants to drill in the Silver City area, and residents showed up to ask questions and express concerns. Victoria Wicks has this report.
In 1872, Congress passed the General Mining Act to promote mining on public lands. The act passed just 4 years after the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 gave exclusive use of western South Dakota, including the Black Hills, to the Great Sioux Nation. 2 years after the act was passed, Lieutenant Colonel George Custer led an expedition into the Black Hills, in part to explore for gold.
With that 1872 mining law, we are not allowed to tell them no. We can only tell them how.
Jessica Eggers is a member of the Mystic District of the U.S. Forest Service, serving as planner for the National Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA. She says her agency can review mining proposals and require changes, but it can't ban the project altogether.
The Forest Service does not own the mining rights to any of our land. We own the surface rights.
Eggers says it's up to Congress to change the law. And that's exactly what Reno Red Cloud says should be done.
We're in the 21st century now, and how do we go about amending these permitting processes and to make them conform to more protection of our environment and our water and our land and our air?
Red Cloud is an officer with the Great Plains Tribal Water Alliance. He says as the planet warms, water protection becomes vital.
Look at climate change coming up, and you know where we're going to be at in 10 years. Water is going to be more valuable than gold.
Red Cloud says tribal consultation is required on a NEPA-permitted project. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The U.S. Census kicks off Tuesday in Tuxuk Bay, Alaska. People in Alaska are traditionally the first to be counted. Census Bureau Director Stephen Dillingham talked about the census at a press conference in Anchorage last week.
Alaska's vast, partly settled areas and most remote parts of the most northern state in our country gets a head start on the national count. These areas are traditionally the first to be counted, and that's continuing with the 2020 census. Our goal is to count everyone once, only once, and to count them in the right place. And we're making available to people and using people and giving people multiple options on how to respond and making sure that they take the extra steps to reach people that have special challenges or circumstances. And that's why the first enumeration is so important. It kind of sets the tone for the rest of the nation.
Census takers will travel by small plane and snowmobile while the ground is still frozen to allow access to remote areas. Residents may be leaving in the spring to fish, hunt, or take seasonal jobs, which census officials say make it difficult to get an accurate count leading up to Census Day on April 1st. Anchorage, Fairbanks, and other portions of Alaska will be counted with the rest of the country beginning in March. The body of Selena Not Afraid has been found. The 16-year-old went missing on New Year's Day in Montana. The Billings Gazette reports law enforcement officials do not suspect foul play in her death. Multiple agencies have been searching for Not Afraid around Interstate 90 between Hardin and Billings, where she was last seen at a rest stop walking away from a broken-down vehicle. Her body was found Monday morning near the rest area. She's the niece of Crow Tribe Chairman Alvin Not Afraid, who expressed sorrow in a statement, adding that grief support will be available for her family and community members. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native Voice One.
the Native American Radio Network.
The United Nations has decided that climate refugees cannot be forced to return home. According to a new decision by the UN Human Rights Committee, refugees feeling the impending effects of climate change cannot be forced back to their home countries. This landmark decision opens the door for a new kind of legal claim to future protections for people whose lives and health are threatened by warming temperatures and rising sea levels. The committee ruling began with the case of Ioan Teitiota, who applied for refugee protection in New Zealand. Teitiota claimed his life was at risk in his home country of Kiribati, which is predicted to be one of the first nations lost to sea level rise. The UN committee rejected his claim that he faced an imminent threat on his life, saying, quote, "Sea level rise is likely to render the Republic of Kiribati uninhabitable. The time frame of 10 to 15 years, as suggested by Teitiota, could allow for intervening acts by the Republic of Kiribati with the assistance of the international community to take affirmative measures to protect and, where necessary, relocate its population," end quote. However, the committee added that all countries would violate a person's international rights if they forced them back to countries where the climate crisis poses an imminent threat. The decision is not legally binding, but does increase obligations that more developed countries will face as the climate crisis intensifies. A World Bank study from 2018 found that 143 people across South Asia, Africa, and Latin America are at risk of becoming climate refugees. The UN Human Rights Committee decision will likely create a wave of legal claims by displaced people around the world.
A study published this week has revealed that at least 62,000 seabirds and possibly up to 1 million died along the West Coast between the summer of 2015 and the spring of 2016. Tens of thousands of common murres, one of the most prolific seabirds, washed up on beaches, many of them emaciated. Researchers are now saying the cause is a persistent and intense marine heat wave. This so-called blob is a wide area of the northeastern Pacific Ocean, with water temperatures several degrees above average. The blob began in 2013 when water in the Gulf of Alaska began to warm. A ridge of high pressure then disrupted weather patterns for years, diverting storms away from the northeastern Pacific. From 2013 to 2016, the pool of warm water inflicted disastrous consequences for the ecosystem up and down the food chain. Researchers also believe their figure represents only a small fraction of the number of animals that perished, as many likely died at sea and were never found. On top of this, scientists also found breeding issues in 22 of the seabird colonies between Alaska and Southern California. The authors wrote in the study, quote, "Die-offs and breeding failures occur sporadically in murres, but the magnitude, duration, and spatial extent of this die-off, associated with multi-colony and multi-year reproductive failures, is unprecedented and astonishing."
The island nation of Madagascar has begun a project that aims to plant 60 million trees over the course of the next few months. The tree planting drive began on January 19th. Which marked the one-year anniversary of the inauguration of President Andry Rajoelina, who had promised to restore the nation's forests. Madagascar is the fourth-largest island in the world, with a landmass of 146 million acres. The island nation is well known for being home to abundant plant and animal life. However, between 2001 and 2018, the expansion of agriculture led to the loss of around one-fifth of the island's tree cover. If this habitat is not restored, it could result in the loss of many native species who do not live anywhere else in the world. On the very first day of the project, over 1 million trees were planted in an area spanning over 1,200 acres, or about one-fourth the size of Forest Park in Portland. The main concern now is keeping up the momentum of the planting and ensuring the protection of the young saplings as they grow.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, January 21st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Kahn, Janka Soderberg, and Joshua Childs. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Ted Jones. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with guest host Jacqueline Keeler, who just returned from a trip across her Navajo homeland to assess their potential impact on the 2020 elections. At 9, it's The Radio Activist, discussing grassroots movements both near and far. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Good night, Jasmine.
Good night, Sam. Good night, Ted.
We are very lucky to be joined on the line by Mickey Huff, the current director of Project Censored, founded in 1976, and president of the Media Freedom Foundation. And he has been a part of Project Censored for quite a while. Thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO, Mickey Huff.
It's always a delight to be on with KBOO in Portland, Oregon. So thanks so much for having us again, and thanks for everything that you do at the station.
Of course. And we're looking back over the last 2 years in this Hindsight 2020 special. And you have put out a book looking back over the top censored stories and media analysis of the last 2 years.